England, but there'll be a significant change in how the weather feels. It will feel cooler and fresher for all of these areas, with temperatures into the low 20s, 22, 23 degrees, for example, from Manchester through Birmingham into the London area. And around some of the North Sea coast, temperatures will just be into the teens, so a fresher feel here as well. For Northern Ireland, a fine day here with sunny spells forecast, highs of around 21 in Belfast. And finally, the forecast for Scotland, well, across eastern areas, a cloudy start to the morning, but here too, we should see the cloud breaking up, sunny spells developing, but a fresher feel to the weather, with temperatures just into the low 20s. That's the latest forecast. Neil, back to you.
All right, many thanks, Chris Fawkes. Now on BBC Radio 4, our new book of the week, Penny Downey reads A Long Walk Home, Judith Tebbutt's account of her 192 days at the hands of Somali pirates back in 2011. In this episode, Judith and her husband have been woken by intruders in their Luxor beach hut while on holiday in Kenya. While her husband struggles with one of the intruders, Judith is dragged away and into a waiting motorboat.
The skiff skimmed and bounced over the top of the waves. When it slammed into a swell, bucket loads of water were flung on board. I was soon soaked and shaking with cold as well as fear. Pain shot up my spine, and I couldn't stop myself from crying out. The five men in their shorts and hooded jackets were oblivious. If this was a kidnap, then I had to assume we were headed for some kind of bolt hole or safe house, maybe further up the coast, where I would be held for money. I told myself that David wouldn't allow this outrage for long. He would come and find me. The navigator sitting behind me came over to my shoulder. "Would you like trousers?" he said. For a muddled instant, all I could think was, he speaks English. I peered more closely at him in the dark. He was tall, maybe 6'4", rail thin and gaunt, with a goatee beard. "Yes, thank you," I replied. And he produced a pair of tracksuit bottoms. Another man was now pressing his bulky black waterproof jacket on me. I was emboldened to speak. "Where are you taking me? What do you want?" The man sitting at my right looked at me and laughed in my face. He seemed very young, 19 or 20. Rubbing his index finger and thumb together, he chanted, "Money, money, money, money." As we neared the shore, Money and another of the men jumped from the boat and waded through knee-high water up onto the sand. I focused on the English-speaking navigator. "Where are we? Is this Lamu?" He shook his head. "Somalia." So, this would be our destination. Away from scenic, civil, tourist-friendly Kenya towards Somalia. A place where the whole world knew the rule of law didn't apply. I had to get a grip on my thoughts. Panic was an indulgence I couldn't afford. The leader muttered something over my head in the direction of the navigator, who tapped my shoulder. "You, sleep now," he said. As I regained consciousness, I could tell that we were slowing down again. The engine had been killed and the skiff was drifting towards the crescent-shaped cove of a mangrove swamp. Those trees, with their twisted, contorted roots and looming branches, had a forbidding look to them, like some gate set up by nature to guard a lost world. Looking about me in the light of daybreak, I could finally make out with clarity the faces of my motley crew of captors. On seeing the man who loaned me his jacket, I thought, "My God, he's the image of Marvin Gaye." The navigator led me to a large shrub where he took a machete and slashed away at its lower branches and then told me to get inside. I gestured I'd like to remove my jacket, or at least doff its hood. But the navigator was adamant, "Your head, you must cover." I sat there, roasting, sweaty, itching from insect bites all over me. Hours passed though I had lost any accurate sense of time. The navigator and Marvin sat opposite me, the leader and Money to one side. They lazed about, talking to each other, their urgency seemingly spent. I longed for home. Wishful scenarios were running through my head of how David and I would speak of this ordeal in the future, rarely, for sure, in hushed tones, thanking our lucky stars. "That time you were taken," David would say. "Thank God it was only days, not months, years," I'd reply. And I had to believe that would be the case, that if I wasn't to be rescued today, then it would have to be tomorrow. To my surprise, my captors, one by one, stretched out on the ground and fell asleep, Money wrapping himself in a filthy pink sheet. Their rifles, AK-47s, old with frayed straps, stayed at their sides. Since I was the only one conscious, I had dared to remove the hood of the jacket. But now Money leapt up, shouting at me, eyes bulging. He grabbed his rifle and pointed it at my head. The navigator was awake too now, and he hastened over to us, but only to take Money's side. "You must keep on," he said sternly. "No hair showing." "Why? It is our religion." Darkness came down. I still hadn't eaten since I'd been snatched away from Ki Wai U. The navigator bought me some tea in a filthy plastic beaker, but I drank it. It was hot and sweet. He lingered and crouched by me. "They need your husband's mobile telephone number. They have to ring him. They want money. When they get money, you go back." "I'm sorry," I said. "I can't remember my husband's number." This was the truth. "Tell them to ring Ki Wai U Village. Speak to the manager, George Moorhead. He will get my husband on the phone. His name is David. Then you can sort this out. He will get you money." After 4 long days, I was moved by boat along the coast, which had changed to one of pristine white sand beaches, completely deserted. The boat began to slow, and I saw ahead of us a bizarre sight. An oil tanker run aground. Money cut the engine. "Why are we stopping?" He pointed a bony finger to the sky. "Planes. How long are we going to be here?"
"Until night. Then tomorrow we take you to Mombasa. You meet David in the Blue Room Hotel. You have heard of it?"
I shook my head, comprehending nothing, but lifted by a tide of euphoria. This horror was going to be over. I was going to see David. He must have sorted everything out, just as I'd known he would. As the morning wore on, in our stationary, unshaded position, the sun's heat grew more fierce. My stomach churned. My throat began to burn with a constant bringing up of bile. The thought of David was the one solace. "Keep it together," I urged myself. "This will be over." Gradually, I was aware of the sun sinking and the heat going out of the day, but let myself feel the thrilling prospect of release. Our progress was slow, the gang scanning the shoreline with fretful eyes, obviously looking for a landmark or beacon of some sort. "They're lost," I thought. The beacon, when it presented itself, turned out to be the flashing headlamps of a four-wheel drive car parked up on the headland over a cove facing full out to sea. My captors sailed us into the shallows of the cove and cut the engine. The moon was bright. Marvin led me on an awkward scramble up the incline to the waiting car, a big beige compact SUV. There, I was pushed into the middle of the back seat, and for a moment I felt oddly uncomfortable to be dripping wet inside a dry vehicle that had sheepskin-covered seats. We drove off at high speed over sand dunes that caused the vehicle to bounce madly up and down. "Can you bloody well slow down?" I shouted to the driver. He only laughed. I was holding tenaciously to just one thought, Mombasa, meaning David. Still, it began to concern me that out of the window of the car I kept seeing the same things, shrubs, bushes, as if we were travelling haphazardly without direction, or at worst, round in circles. The car's clock read 5 a.m. and though the flat desert landscape all around us was darkened, there was a coral orange glow on the horizon that signalled the dawn. The driver brought us to a halt, and my captors climbed out and commenced the ritual of their morning prayer as the sun struggled up. The terrain around us had a stark, forbidding form of beauty. My hopes of being reunited with David in Mombasa had begun to feel thin, deluded, supplanted in my head by a growing fear that some new, awful unknown was about to be visited on me. We came out of desert into scrubland. At first I thought I was experiencing a mirage when in the distance I saw a camel train, but it was real and bizarrely breathtaking. "Are we going to Mombasa?" I asked. Marvin said something to the others, and they all laughed. So, I had my answer. In time, a village loomed before us on a plain surrounded by dunes and scrub brush. Before me, the big, grey steel gates of some kind of compound standing open onto a yard. We pressed on through this entrance, pulled up, and the gates of my new prison closed immediately behind us. Within those metal gates, the first sensations to strike me were of searing heat and hard light bouncing off the thick stone walls of the enclosed yard. Marvin pulled me up steps formed in the dirt by foot traffic through the metal double doors furthest to the left. Within was a gloomy room, maybe 15 feet square, with a high ceiling to which plastic sheets bearing an Arabic pattern in bright blue and yellow had been nailed up. There were no windows that I could see, and only a little natural light seeping in through breeze blocks set in the wall near the ceiling. "Okay," I told myself. "You've been unharmed to this point, more or less. Keep your head and see where this leads." I could feel a sort of calm settle on me. I had to expect I would be held there until a ransom was paid for me. So I needed to stay strong. I would have to devise a structure, a routine that could occupy my days. I began to pace out the length and breadth of the room, and curiously, just walking round the space of my confinement made me feel a little better. It seemed to me I ought to have enough stamina to walk for about half an hour every hour of the day. While I paced, I could hear men outside talking, laughing. Eventually, Marvin returned bearing a small ladder, accompanied by a woman dressed in the full enveloping jilbab and kimar. The woman made up my bed, chatting away in my direction as if I could understand her every word. For all that I was baffled, I found her presence welcome in the circumstances. Marvin then hefted in a cardboard box that was filled with a dozen small bottles of water. I was also given a battery-powered lantern and, perhaps best of all, a purple bar of soap. It had got dark outside when the woman in the jilbab returned, on her own. She came towards me, bearing a pair of samosas nestling in an aluminium bowl, exuding just-cooked warmth, smelling delicious. She put her finger to her lips and showed me a complicit smile. One woman to another. A gesture of surprising kindness.
And tomorrow, Judith receives a long-awaited phone call from home as Penny Downey reads the next installment of A Long Walk Home by Judith Tabbett. The abridger was Miranda Davis and the producer was Justine Willett. Here's Sailing By to take us to the shipping forecast. Now on BBC Radio 4, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Wednesday, the 10th of July. There are warnings of gales in South Tsera and Fisher. The general synopsis at 1800, high Rorqual 1032, expected Malin 1029 by 1800 Wednesday. New high expected Forth 1028 by same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. West Viking, northwesterly backing westerly later 4 or 5, decreasing 3 at times, fair, good. East Viking, North Tsera, South Tsera, northerly 5 to 7, occasionally gale 8 in South Tsera, fair, good. Forties, northerly 3 or 4, increasing 5 or 6 in east, mainly fair, moderate or good.